Welcome to another episode of The Gary Hour. I am your host, Gary Levitt, where each week I talk to interesting people about the things that matter most to them and me. This week I talk to AJ Jacobs, who's a best-selling author, New York Times style. He's got not one New York Times best-selling book, but four. They include My Life as an Experiment, The Year of Living Biblically, where he lived each day according to the Bible, Drop Dead Healthy, where he went on a quest to become the healthiest man alive, and The Know-It-All, where he read the entire encyclopedia A to Z. Well, AJ's got a new book that I read, and it is great. It's called Thanks a Thousand, and he tries to thank every single person that went into making his morning cup of coffee. And it turns out that's thousands of people. We'll get into that and more. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. If you're a musician, a podcaster, filmmaker, voiceover artist, or if you just make videos, go to the App Store and search for Future Moments, because they have an app that'll make your life easier and your productions better. Okay, before we get to my conversation with AJ, I've got a little thing I want to throw out to the ether for Bed Bath & Beyond. Hey, Bed Bath & Beyond, if you're listening, I've got a stand-up bit that I want to make into a commercial for you. It always works. If you want to see the video, go to my YouTube channel, Gary Levitt. I'm Gary Levitt everywhere on the internet. Very easy to find. Hope you enjoyed this stand-up bit from the Greenwich Village Comedy Club.
Did you guys know that Bed Bath & Beyond is a lifetime return policy? Yeah, lifetime return policy. Our whole lives. Everything we own, we can return it. I'm so holding those guys to it. It's all going back. Everything I own is going back. My blankets are going back. My pillows are going back. I will return my deathbed. It's all going back. I'm keeping all the receipts. I'm stapling them to my will. Like a maniac. It's all going back. It's going to be like I never existed at all. I think that's what they mean by the beyond. It's all going back. People used to ask me, they'd be like, Gary, would you want to live forever? And I'd be like, forever? I don't have enough underwear. But now that I know about this return policy, yes, I do. You're going to see me in 400 years. I'm going to walk into a Bed Bath & Beyond like, can I return this coffee cup? Just to see how far I can stretch this return policy. My set is brought to you by Bed Bath & Beyond. I tried this bit at a show the other night, and after the whole comedy show was over, this woman's walking up to me. I'm getting excited, you know, I'm thinking she's going to compliment me for my art. And she goes to me, was that true in there? Was that true? Bed Bath & Beyond is a lifetime return policy? How sad is that? I mean, that woman sat for a whole comedy show, and that is her takeaway.
Haha, that was my Bed Bath & Beyond bit. Hope you enjoyed that. But most of all, I hope you enjoy this conversation I had with AJ Jacobs, whose book, Thanks a Thousand, just came out. Available Barnes & Noble, anywhere books are sold. Enjoy my conversation, and thank you for listening.
Oh, something's going.
Something's moving. That's good. Okay.
Look at that. It's got the thousandth of the second. That is...
It's beyond the
impressive.
Moment. The micro moment is being recorded. Oh, my God.
Okay. I love it.
All right, AJ Jacobs, you have quite the bio.
Well, thank you, Gary. So do you.
Don't turn this podcast around. This is... So you're a writer and an immersion journalist.
Sure, that's what some people call me, and I'm happy with it.
Yeah, you do these life experiments. All right, you read every book of the encyclopedia.
Right, from A to Z.
From A to Z, you lived 1 year of your life as the Bible tells you to do.
Right. Old Testament, all the laws.
And you somehow stayed married throughout all of this.
Barely, but yes.
I think what's most amazing is, beyond your writing, is that your wife stayed with you.
I am very lucky that way. And I get a lot of, she gets a lot of emails saying, you know.
She does, huh?
Yeah, which I'm happy with. And she makes a good, like, I'm very happy I married her. Not just because I do love her, but she's also a great character. Like, she is a great foil. So she, like, I couldn't have written a better fictional character.
Yeah, it makes me curious about her, because you lived with, you must have been so dirty living a year as the Bible tells you to do.
Well, the Bible does not forbid showers. But yeah, you look dirty, certainly, because the Bible says you cannot shave the corners of your beard.
Right.
And I didn't know where the corners were, so I just let the whole thing grow. And I look, not, you know, I look Ted Kaczynski-like. I look...
No mixing fabrics.
Yes, no mixing fabrics. So you had to wear clothes made of just one fiber, like, you know, no poly cotton blends. So I had to get rid of those. But yeah, she didn't mind that as much as the beard. She was really offended by the beard, mm-hmm. which I did wash. I did shampoo it, but she wouldn't kiss me for 7 months.
Seven months.
Yeah. No, like no physical contact.
She really hated the beard that much. Huh?
She did. Well, she was also pregnant. So she was like, I'm not in the mood.
Mm. So yes, you were fruitful.
There you go. Exactly. That is the first commandment in the Bible before the Ten Commandments.
Were you religious before this?
No, not at all. I grew up, as I say in the book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian.
Right, so, right.
No, I had no bar mitzvah, no seders, but I had a kid and I wanted to know what to teach him about religion. You know, is there anything to it? Mm-hmm. So I thought I'm going to dive in and live my life by the Bible, see what I learn.
Right.
And
I didn't see this anywhere. Is it Old Testament that you did?
It is mostly Old Testament. Yeah. I also spent some time with the New Testament, but the Old Testament is where all of the fun laws
That's
are.
That's the crazy one.
That's the crazy one.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I tried to be balanced because I do think there are some wonderful things about religion and the Bible,
yeah,
like community and loving your neighbors and embracing the outcast. But there's also flat out insanity,
mm-hmm,
like
right.
Stoning adulterers. And so I wanted to show both sides. I wanted to show, don't take the Bible literally. That's crazy.
Right.
Don't be a fundamentalist, because otherwise you will be walking around looking like I looked, and you will be... I mean, one of my favorite laws that I was able to follow,
mm-hmm,
that I actually think is a good law in retrospect, it's the Bible says, if two men are in a fight and the wife of one of those men grabs the testicles of the other man, then you have to cut off her hand.
This is in the Old Testament.
That is word for word what's in the Old Testament.
Now I see why they revised it to make a New Testament. What is the deal with the New Testament? Why? How could you just take a holy book and rewrite it and say, oh, don't pay attention to that old one. We meant this.
Well, they don't say don't pay attention this much. Some parts they say you can ditch, but they sort of see it as a prequel. Like the New Testament is the main event, but the Old Testament is pretty important.
So it's like Star Wars, Return of the Jedi kind of thing?
Yes, I think that is a perfect analogy.
But most people don't pay attention to the Old Testament these days.
True. Well, I mean, it's interesting just doing this. Maybe in our circles, that's true, but millions of people take it very seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, just looking at... that 40% of Americans, this was the latest poll I read, still believe in young earth creationism and that the earth is 5,000 years old.
Oh, evangelicals kind of.
Right, evangelical. Yeah. And so that's Old Testament. And that was part of my point. It's like, you don't have to believe every word of the Bible literally for it to have meaning for you. So yeah, I mean, just... I loved talking to these creationists, not because I agreed with them. Mm-hmm. I totally disagreed, but it was fascinating to see the motivated reasoning that they had. Like, they had in their mind that God created the world, 6,000 years ago. Right. And they,
despite what science says.
Despite what 99.999% of legitimate science says. But they're not dumb people, but they were able to come up with these mental gymnastics to prove their point. And
did you end up in a lot of debates or conversations while you were doing this experiment?
I did. Well, I didn't try to go in as a debate. I tried to go in to interview them and get their point of view.
Like, I imagine a lot of them were affronted by it.
Well, it was weird. There were some people offended, but people were far more open, because I tried to go in with, like, you know, I'm just doing this. I'm not trying to judge. I'm just seeing what's in the Bible. And it was funny, because when the book came out, it was fascinating to see people's confirmation bias again, mm-hmm. because people who were atheists read the book and wrote me or told me, thank you for showing us how bonkers the Bible is and
right.
like how nuts these rules are. But then I would get some religious people who said, thank you for showing me the good side of religion, and, you know, you helped me connect
with... But what about the part of grabbing the balls and throwing stones at the person?
Well, I think people think that grabbing the balls, don't grab balls, is a good piece of wisdom. I mean, it's not up there with don't thou shalt not kill.
Right.
But don't grab... I guess, you know...
But it says to grab the balls, or you can grab the balls.
No.
Oh, it says don't grab the balls.
Yeah, maybe I...
But you can throw rocks.
Yes, you should stone adulterers. Not just adulterers, though. I mean, in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, there's a long list of people to stone. There's astrologers.
You should stone astrologers.
Yeah,
and right. I did. A false god.
Yeah, false god.
Right.
And Sabbath breakers and children who disobey their parents are supposed to be. Well, I definitely wield that at home.
What can you do to children that disobey their parents?
Oh, you take them to the gates of the city and stone them to death.
You can.
Yeah. No, that's perfect.
As a father, I'm sure you didn't do that.
I didn't do that. Well, it was interesting. Yeah, but the parenting advice. Because some, you know, the Bible, that's one thing I thought was a big point. Like, the Bible is not a monolith. It was mm-hmm. written by dozens of people.
Right.
So some parts are wonderful, and, you know, some parts love your kids and love your neighbors. But then there are all these parts written by, I think, people who were, you know, obviously had mental issues. Mm-hmm. And the Proverbs say that you should hit your kid with a rod, with a stick. Don't spare the rod. Don't spoil the child and use a rod to punish them.
So the Bible's telling you to beat your children.
Right. That's exactly what it says.
But the laws are telling you cannot beat your children.
That was the complication. And I would try to find ways around it. So, for instance, for the beating the kids part, my kid was like really young at the time, like 2 or 3. And I would... I bought a Nerf rod, uh-huh. like a bat that was covered in Nerf. And I went and I just whacked him when he was bad. And he thought it was hilarious.
Right.
And he would run and go get like a wiffle bat from the closet and just start wailing on me.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn, this is not the proper message. But there are people who still beat their kids. I don't think they sell it anymore. But a few years ago, they sold a biblical rod. You could buy it. That was like, you know, for hitting your kids.
Well, like a holy rod for beating your children.
Yeah, I don't know if they said it was holy, but they were like, this is biblically approved.
Was the year of living biblically the toughest life experiment you did?
I do think so, in some senses. Others, in this sense, it was, in that I had to change. I had to change the way I looked with the beard and dressed with, like, I wore a white robe because the Bible says you should only wear white.
So you're always wearing a white robe.
I looked like Tom Wolfe, but with a robe. Mm-hmm. And then the way I spoke, I couldn't covet or lie or gossip. And I live in New York City and work as a journalist, so that's like, you know, 80% of my day.
How was it? You must have had very different reactions from strangers, just you walking down the street.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a real lesson in first impression, how much of life is based on our looks.
Right.
And I guess Facebook has really, unfortunately, emphasized that. But people's reactions, I mean, and they varied. They ran the gamut. So some people, they saw this guy and they would cross the street to avoid me, like take their kids. Other people, it was very nice. They thought I was homeless and would give me money. So uh-huh. Which I would then donate. I felt like, biblically, I should donate to charity.
Right.
So I didn't, like, make a lot of money panhandling, inadvertent panhandling.
Were you tempted? Was it actually kind of lucrative?
Well, yeah, I don't think. I made, like, you know, maybe 10, 12 bucks. So.
Uh-huh. In a year, that's not very good.
Yeah, not, I wouldn't recommend. But then but there were other people who had the opposite reaction. They, you know, since I sort of looked spiritual and holy, because I looked like a religious person, they would,
that archetype of the wise man with the beard,
exactly.
Yeah.
So they would, like, feel, I got some friends who were like, I just feel like I can't curse around you, I feel like I need to act morally around you.
Interesting. Right, it's like they say people with fatter faces are funnier.
Oh, I didn't know that.
People feel warmer around them, and people with narrow faces like mine, people are like, he's mean.
I have a very narrow face too, so we're both.
I try
mean.
To puff out my cheeks before I go on
oh,
stage.
Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Just shove some cotton in there, and you will do much better.
I do my best Louis Armstrong impersonation.
That is interesting. Yeah, it is very interesting, the stereotypes we have about people's weight and the jolly fat person.
Yeah, I'm not really sure if that's nature or just something that's nurtured by the characters that we grew up with.
Right, you know? Exactly.
It could be just something inherent in the human psyche.
Right. I was thinking, Halloween was recently, like, when will it be not okay to dress as a fat person? Because
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, that is cultural appropriation of being fat, like, you know, that
the fat suit
is not
or dressing as a carrot.
The carrot lobby is strong.
Yes, carrots have feelings too.
I actually went to a philosophy conference where we discussed, do plants have feelings?
Uh-huh. Well, they say plants do if you're mean to them. They've done these tests where if you yell and you're mean to a plant,
like to see those studies. I'd like to see them replicated.
What did you learn in this?
Well, I mean, the idea was they don't have a nervous system like us. But
uh-huh.
the question is how do we know thing? You know, it was all about how do we know what we know,
right?
And what
we're only using our own yardstick. You
true.
Know, we're using a human yardstick. Maybe we don't know how to relate to a plant. They're on a totally different.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can't measure that.
By the way, I'm sorry to veer off.
It's okay.
But I figure you're okay. I've listened to your show. I watched Harry Potter, the movie, the second movie, with my kids last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a scene where there are these plants that have some magic potion in them. I forget. Wait, what were they? I forget what kind of plants they were. But they would pull them out, and it would look like a screaming baby when they pulled them out. Do you
uh-huh.
remember that scene at all?
I do not. I did not see Harry Potter.
It was so disturbing.
Yeah.
Because it was like, obviously, these plants have the ability to feel pain. They're screaming,
mm-hmm.
and they look like people. And the kids were just having a great time pulling these screaming plants out. And it's like,
human nature.
What kind? Yeah. Well, wizard nature.
Right.
It was like, you sadistic mother.
Yeah.
It's like, Jesus.
So you also did a life experiment where you couldn't lie.
That's true. I did and it was an article. It was like 10 years ago.
How long did you not lie for?
That was a couple of months. And it started, it was because I had read about a movement called Radical Honesty.
Right.
And it was started by this psychologist in Virginia who's mm-hmm. a wacko. I love him. And Brad Blanton. And he believes that you should never lie.
Mm-hmm.
But he goes further than that. He says whatever's on your brain should come out of your mouth, like no filter. So, you know, the classic, I think you look your ass looks fat in that dress, say it.
Like, okay, there's a difference between radical honesty and saying every thought that's in your mind.
Right. But he doesn't believe so. He said he believes suppressing your thoughts is a form of lying. So you got to say it. Like if you are fantasizing about your wife's sister, tell your wife and tell the sister.
Wow.
And I was like, and he believes, you know, it's not just sadistic. He believes this will create a better society. This will be authentic.
I do see the merits of the radical honesty, but there's also tact.
Yes. Well, that was sort of what I discovered. It was very interesting. I mean, there are huge downsides, but also upsides. I mean, the downsides are quite obvious. It was like, it was hell because
what's the worst thing that happened to you with this radical honesty?
Well, I remember we were at a restaurant and we saw some friends of my wife's who she hadn't seen since college, and they were all excited to see us and or see her and said, "Oh, we should all get together and have a play date with our kids." And I had to say what was on my mind, which was, you know, you seem nice enough, but I just really don't have interest in seeing you again.
You like, said that out loud to them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they like laughed nervously and they were like, then they were offended, rightfully so. And my wife was hugely pissed off and it was horrible. So like, I don't recommend that.
So what happened after that?
Well, we never saw him again. Never. So
did she apologize to them for you?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if she ever did.
Did she explain that you were doing this experiment?
I can't remember whether we had time before they left. I think that she did, yes. That does take a little of the edge off of it, but not totally. I mean, it's still pretty harsh. So I don't recommend that because that's sort of the brutal honesty side. But there are parts of it that were wonderful because it's liberating. First of all, you don't have to remember all your lies. Like, that takes a lot of energy.
Absolutely. The clarity of conscience.
Yeah.
You know, you just flow. You get in the flow of things.
You do. And I mean, it's like you know, when I say, you know, I am free that night, but I just don't feel like going out. Mm-hmm. That there is something, it's a little rough when you say it, but it's liberating because it's true. And it's also, you don't have to remember, oh, I pretended to be sick that day.
It's also really good for a marriage. I think a lot of relationships in general, whether they're romantic or friendly, communication is always the cause of all the problems. It's almost always the root.
Yeah.
The people forget to communicate.
True.
So what you're doing is just blasting those gates of communication wide open.
I would say you want to keep them partially closed. Yes. Not everything should be communicated, but a good amount. I mean, I also think this actually does help with marriage and life in general, is being radically honest when you mess up. Mm. And I love that. Like,
can you give an example?
Well, I mean, I just think when I started my career and I would make a mistake, I would do everything I could to cover it up and not tell my bosses.
Right.
And now, if I make a mistake, I am right out front. Like, if I write an article or I write a book that has a factual error, I am not going to hide it. And so... and I do that, you know, when I do interviews and I say, like, in my book on health, you know, there were some things that no longer are true. So I'm not going to pretend that, you know, there's been studies questioning whether flossing is actually. And I have this section in my book about flossing will save your life. Because at the time, that's what the study said. So just being honest, you know, no one's perfect. To reveal your flaws and you will feel liberated.
Wait, is flossing good or bad now?
Well,
it's got to be good.
I don't want to get in trouble with the ADA because those guys are harsh. But
they're really listening.
It feels like it would be good for you.
Yeah.
Like you feel like you're doing something. Mm-hmm. But there, and it is possible that it is healthy. But the meta study that I read most recently said there is no formal proof yet that it will
it's gotta be good. I mean, if I'm flossing and I pull a big piece of cookie out of between my teeth. I mean, that's got to be good to get that out.
Well, you say that, but that's the way, I mean, that's the same argument as colonics. Like, colonics have to be good because you're getting all that shit out. And they're not. There's no, like, it's not good. The body cleans itself. The body, you don't need to shoot water up your ass to clean your ass. The body does it.
Watch out, the colonic people are going to come at you.
I'm ready for them because I got a colonic as part of my health book.
And you did, huh?
And listen, if you enjoy it, if it's something that like feels good to you, then I'm like, oh, go for it. Just have fun. But don't claim that it's like going to make you healthier and live longer.
Right. Okay. So during this time of brutal honesty.
Yeah.
You must.
No, not brutal. That's the important thing. It's radical honesty because brutal is only the negative.
Right.
Radical can be also, you can be radically positive. Like, I really, like, I remember during this, I called my mentor, who I hadn't spoken to in 15 years. He's an editor at a small newspaper. And I was like, you know, I just want to let you know, I really appreciate all you taught me. So that's radical positive honesty. So it's a combination.
Right. So if you have negative thoughts,
yes,
you have to express them now.
Yes, yes, yes. And that is hard. And that is, it's also not just hard, it's creepy.
Right.
Because like I have a scene in the article where I go out to lunch with an editor who was a woman. And like in the middle of lunch, I say, I'm just thinking about how when we first met, you were wearing a sleeveless tank top. And that is like Me Too horrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, luckily she wasn't offended and she said something funny back. I can't remember. But yeah, and Brad Blanton, the founder of Radical Honesty, is honest about this.
Is he in prison?
No, he's not in prison, as far as I know. But he says part of the motivation for Radical Honesty, for inventing it, was to sleep with women. Because if you go up to 100 women as your opening line and say, I just want to let you know, I'm really attracted to you and I would love to go back. You know, I would love to get a private room with you.
Right.
99% will be offended or slap you in the face, but there will be.
Sure, you're playing the numbers.
Yeah, playing the numbers.
Yeah.
Which I, you know, obviously I do not endorse as a way to, especially in the post Me Too era.
Of course. But the mind is a pack of wild horses. It could just like, if you've ever meditated, and I'm sure you have, you know your mind just goes boom, 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 and just thinking of ridiculous, stupid, nonsensical things sometimes.
That's so true, yeah. Our thoughts are often incredibly dumb and wrong. So that was one of my arguments.
And nonsensical. So to have to express that is so dangerous.
Yeah. And that's what I also, that was an argument I made to Blanton. I said, I love my wife 90% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
10% of the time, I hate her because she's done something that just drives me crazy. Why should I, those 10% of the time, say, God, I hate you, when I know it's going to pass? It's going to be a couple hours. And he's like, well, that's the authentic. Then you won't be tiptoeing around like a pussy. And I was like, I don't know. I don't buy it. But
And since you did this life experiment, you could see how it worked out.
Right.
Did it make your marriage more difficult?
Well, at times, I mean, as I say, the radical positive part, I do try to keep. And that part is like being really honest and open about what you appreciate. And the whole idea of saying, you know, I'm so grateful that you picked our kids up from the orthodontist. Like that kind of stuff does help. You know what? I did another experiment that actually helped my marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, this was suggested by readers because they had read my books, like the Bible one where I was kind of a pain in the ass with the beard. and they're like, you should make it up to your wife by doing a month of just everything she wants, you do. Like you are totally subservient.
Uh-huh.
Like you are whipped.
Do you have to tell her that you're doing this?
Oh, I did tell her.
Uh-oh.
I did. And she got drunk with power. Like
I'll bet you just want to see how sadistic she can get.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, it went from everything. It was like, you know, it was like almost like a Kate Hudson movie. Like she just, you know, foot rubs. And we did watch a lot of romantic comedies, which I like. So that wasn't too torturous.
But that also can kind of take the pressure off because you are not really making any decisions.
True. Yeah, it was a bit. But you know what was enlightening about it is she asked that we make a list of all the things that she does around the house and all the things that I do. Mm-hmm. And I honestly, before that, was under the delusion that we like split things pretty much 50-50.
Uh-huh.
But just seeing the list, it was like 80-20. Like she did all these things that I didn't know happened. Mm-hmm. It was like I thought that the liquid soap just refilled itself somehow. I didn't know that someone had to go in and fill those containers.
Right.
So that was enlightening. And, you know, in a sense, it was bad for me because now I have to do more stuff around the house,
mm-hmm.
but good for our marriage.
She sounds like such an amazing woman.
She is. Yes, I am very lucky. I mean, she's also good for me in that I think I was born more the introvert and she's the extrovert. And she has pulled me a little towards the extrovert side, mm-hmm. which I appreciate because even though like she likes going out to dinner with friends and I
before, until you ruined all of her friends
until I told them all I didn't want to see them ever again. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see before I go out to dinner with friends, it still happens. I'm like, God damn it. I just want to stay at home and watch mm-hmm. Netflix. But when I'm out with the friends and having a good time and learning the new things and their perspective, I'm like, this is good. This is what I should be doing.
Yeah,
as a kid.
I have that feeling all of the time.
Do you?
Yeah. I mean, I was so excited to come and talk to you, but then today I just like, I don't want to go and anywhere.
Well, like, thank you for forcing yourself to go.
My radical honesty is I was dreading this.
You are hilarious. And well, I hope. I'm
starting to dread everything I do. And then after I do it, I'm just like, I feel so alive and I'm so glad that I did it.
I know. And why can't we take that mentality and like, that is what I try to do. Like when I'm in that, God, I just don't want to leave. I tell myself, you know what? Your future self will be happy you did it. So do a little favor to yourself.
I know that's just so not living in the moment, though.
Yeah, that's true. But maybe that's okay. Maybe we shouldn't live in the moment. Who knows?
Yeah, I have so much to say right now. Okay, I got to slow my brain down. So, okay, the radical honesty thing, I think there's so much good to it. But my personal philosophy is be wary of all extremes.
Agree. You know, I'm with you.
I am never feeling like any extreme is good. It's always a happy medium.
Yes.
That's almost always the answer. I'm not even going to say always the answer. I'm going to say almost always
the answer.
Well, that's
the classic moderation in everything, including moderation. You want to be moderate about everything,
right.
including sometimes you don't want to be moderate because like, you know, on Thanksgiving, you don't want to be moderate in eating. You just want to stuff your face because it's a good ritual to stuff your face.
As long as you don't do it every day.
Exactly. I am with you 100%. And that's kind of one of the overarching themes of my projects is I go to the extreme to show that it's dangerous. But I try to find what is good and take that with me so that at the end, I can have some positive takeaways, but I don't have to stay with the extreme. And that was even in the book about health. Mm-hmm. Like one of the takeaways was it's unhealthy to be too obsessed with health. Like if you spend all your time at the gym or you know, running 14 miles a day, not just physically unhealthy, but it's mentally unhealthy because we are designed as humans to have lots of interaction with other humans.
And, absolutely. Yeah. I've been saying that for years. The stress of worrying about what you're eating is going to kill you.
There you go. I know. There's this doctor I talked to who actually has a word for it. He calls it orthorexia, being overly, it's like a eating disorder, being overly obsessed with healthy food. Orthorexia.
I'm glad there's a term for it.
So go ahead and eat all the crap you want. That's the takeaway.
Happy medium.
Yes, exactly. Happy medium.
So I'm glad to hear that you dread doing things as well, even though you know intellectually that it's going to be good for you.
Right.
So do you have any tools? I mean, you said you know that future AJ will be happy that you did that.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what you do? You just be like, all right, I'm dreading this, but I'm going to drag my feet. I'm going to sag my ass out there, and then I'll be happy later.
I do. That is part of it. Another part is just forcing yourself to act as if.
So fake it till you make it.
Fake it till you make it, or fake it till you feel it.
Right.
I mean, to give you an example, when I was writing the health book, it was just horrible because it was such a big topic. And I was like, I don't know what I'm talking about. Also, I was like, I hate exercise. So it's like, what the hell am I doing? But so I would wake up every morning in despair. But what I did was I forced myself to act as if I were confident and as if I were really excited about the book. So I might call my publisher and say, you know what, we should have a big party when the book comes out and we'll serve kale martinis and it'll be like the healthiest book party ever.
Uh-huh.
And or then I'd like set up interviews with 5 doctors. And by acting as if I were confident,
right,
my brain caught up after like 2 or 3 hours and I began to feel a little more confident. And it is a super powerful strategy, and it's the basis for cognitive behavioral therapy. You
know? Right, like, CBT.
Yeah, which I love. Like, act your way into a new way of thinking instead of think your way into a new way of acting.
That's good.
I didn't make that up.
Right. Do you study? Have you studied that NLP kind of thing?
I've not gotten that into NLP, but mm-hmm. Have you?
A little bit.
I don't know much about it. What should I know?
Well, you basically just kind of like what you're saying, except you reprogram your reactions to things.
Mm.
So instead of just reacting how you might always react, you consciously think about how you want to react. And then you're basically just reprogramming your brain.
So you visualize that, like you visualize a
yeah,
a
you're scenario. Basically just programming your brain.
All right, I'll try it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I try to do, like when I'm dreading doing something, even though I know I'm going to be happy I did it.
Right. So you visualize, you like.
Yeah, I guess it's like it's pretty similar to what you said earlier, just knowing that I'll be happy when I do it.
Right. Well, I think it is very powerful, this idea of the future self. And I've read studies that the more you think about your future self, the better you act. You act more morally, you act more health. And I took this when I did the health book. I took it very literally. Mm-hmm. So there are these programs on the internet. You take your photo and you can digitally age it.
Right.
So I digitally aged myself until I was like saggy cheeked and gray hair and looked like shit. And then I printed that out and put it over my desk. And sometimes if I was like feeling lazy or like I'm not gonna work out today, I would look at my old self and I'd be like, you know what? I should do it for that guy.
Why? Because it reminds you of your mortality?
Yeah, it reminds you of your mortality. And that guy, because the idea is there are two selves. There's the present self that just wants to sit on the couch and eat Cheetos.
Right.
And then there's the future self that wants that present self to like take care of. So the future self will be around. And that's the idea. It's like, I want to be around to see my kids grow up. Like I do want.
Right.
So it's not like.
That must help when you were doing the health book.
It does. Because I am, you know, I am married now, so I've kind of given up. And I don't like, I don't care if I look good or have abs, much to my wife's dismay. But I do want to live.
We'll edit that part out.
We'll make a special version just for her.
Yes.
I do want to be around. So that is a good motivation. I find thinking about others is weirdly at this point in my life more motivating than thinking like, oh, I'm going to look hot. Because looking hot to me, that doesn't get me nothing.
Like, gets you better reactions from people. People probably give you free coffee.
You know what? You're right. You are absolutely. I mean,
it has been proven in tests that attractive people get more things.
Yes, you're right. I take it back because, I think this lookism, like this, mm-hmm. This obsession with attractiveness is a real problem. And ugly people are definitely discriminated against. And you know what? Not just ugly people, ugly animals.
Yeah.
I feel that like.
Sure.
You know.
If you go to any pet adoption place, it's always the ugly, weird-looking pets that are never adopted.
Oh, that's interesting. I was thinking more just like what gets eaten. Like you eat, like you right. feel fine eating like a turkey or a chicken because they're ugly, but
right.
like a swan. I mean, it's just another bird, but you would never eat a swan or a songbird because they're right. so attractive. And dogs are so adorable, but like, why should we prefer to eat a cow? Cows are ugly,
yeah.
but they are, you know, they
I have that problem with mice because I think mice are cute.
Like that's interesting.
They remind me of little baby kittens.
So do you keep mice around the apartment? Are you okay with that?
We did have a mice infestation, and I had a problem. I was like, it was a paradox for me.
So what did you end up doing?
I mean, it's gross. I had to get rid of them, you know,
yeah,
because
yeah,
they poop all
germs.
Over, and
right.
it's not healthy.
So how'd you end up doing it?
You know, the traps. But actually, that was very temporary. What actually worked was peppermint Dr. Bronner soap. They do not like peppermint.
Really?
So if you just put peppermint soap all over where they're coming in, they won't come in anymore.
All right, I'm going to try it.
Do you have mice?
I love peppermint.
Yeah, and it makes the place smell good.
Yeah, we on and off have mouse problems. I mean, at one point, my son, who's very pro animals, convinced me to get a... one of those humane mouse traps.
Yeah.
Which, like, the mouse goes in and the door shuts and then you can let him out in the park. The problem was, like, I put one and then I kind of totally forgot about it. And
oh.
So it caught a mouse and then, like, basically the mouse starved to death and I caused so much more suffering
yes.
with this. So I was a total asshole and it totally backfired.
First, you put him in solitary confinement.
Exactly. Not good for his mental health. Not good. So, yeah.
Yeah, you drove him crazy and then you starved him to death.
I know. It was terrible. I do that. Yeah. So if I do that again, I'm going to be much more aware.
Yeah, if you do have a mouse problem, just put peppermint soap all
okay,
over.
Okay, that's good. That sounds much more humane.
Mm-hmm. It actually worked.
Yeah, good.
Getting back to what we were talking about before with dreading everything,
mm-hmm.
another conundrum is that if I did that, if I did what you do and I put a picture of old Gary on my wall,
yeah,
and I thought about old Gary wants younger Gary to experience as much as life
Right.
as much as life has to offer.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, where I am now, I look back and all the amazing things I've done, and it's like, those are just memories.
Huh, interesting.
What good is that?
Really? I think memories are the only thing that's good. Like, I see sometimes my life as just, I'm a collector of good memories.
Yeah.
And
does that make it worth it?
I don't know. Sometimes. It's interesting because another experiment I did relates to this somewhat. I tried to do what is called life logging, which is uh-huh. this idea that you should record everything in your life. And I went the full Monty and recorded. I had a little video camera in my ear for about 3 months recording every moment of my life.
Wow.
And the idea was, you know, first of all, if my kids did something cute, I would always have that memory.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also because our memories suck so much, and yep. we forget, but we also what we remember we distort. So it was partly because my wife, when I have an argument with her, often it's about like, you didn't tell me that, or that's not what you said.
Right.
So I'm like, this will be great. I can like say, well, let's go to the videotape. Let's rewind and see what actually happened.
Yeah.
And I was able to do that a couple of times, and it was horrible. It was like a disaster.
Why did it go poorly?
Well, either way, it was going to suck. Because if I was wrong, and she, you know, then I like that was sucked for me.
Right, right.
But if I was right, then she just got angrier.
Right.
Like,
because no one likes to be called out.
No one likes to be called out. And I videotaped this one time where, like, we got in a fight. She was screaming at me. And I was like, you know what? This will be instructive. Let's watch the fight and see what we did wrong and what we can do.
Did she agree to that?
She agreed to it. And, like, looking at yourself screaming at someone is such a traumatic, like, she was so traumatized by that. She's like, fuck this, I am never doing that again. And then the article came out, and the Today, I had written about that part, and the Today Show wanted me on, and they're like, all right, well, like, we're going to need that videotape of your wife screaming at you. And I was like, all right. And my wife's like, are you kidding me? I am not going on national television like looking like a maniac, because no one looks good when they're screaming. Like, right. You look insane.
But everyone's done it.
Everyone's done it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like,
so did you not bring the tape?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm still married. If I had brought the tape, that would be the end of it.
That's good. I'm glad you valued your marriage over the TV show.
I do. It was close, but yeah.
Was it before Megyn Kelly on the Today Show?
Mm-hmm. You know what is weird?
What?
Megyn Kelly wrote in her autobiography, which my mother-in-law read, I didn't read it, how much she loved the radical honesty piece in Esquire.
And so you probably helped get her fired.
Well, that's the thing. I felt like I was thinking, like, yeah, if you have thoughts that are not good, don't be radically honest with them. Like, so I think there was a sense she was trying to be radically honest. I'm just telling it like it is.
Right.
And it's like, no, that's not always the best way, especially on national television.
There's definitely a lot more good than bad, I would think, with the radical honesty.
Bad than good or good than bad?
A lot more good than bad.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to quantify.
If you have that part of your brain that can censor and understand tactfulness.
Right. I agree. I mean, it did make my life better in overall. Like, the things that I took away, like I told you, radical positive honesty, mm-hmm. radically just owning up to your fuck-ups is so freeing. And also the excuses. That's the third thing that changed. Like, you know, if I really don't want to go out, I can just say, you know what, I just need to spend some time at home with my kids, or time at home and catch up, catch my breath. Instead of coming up with, like, you know, oh, it's my grandmother's, you know, 80th anniversary or whatever.
Feigning some illness.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
That kind of thing is the, like I was getting at before, it's the problem, the root of many problems in relationships. You kind of just push stuff under the rug.
Right.
Feelings. So I imagine a lot of your relationships kind of got a lot better after the radical honesty.
It's true. It was interesting. There was one scene where I was having lunch with a friend of mine, and I forget what we were talking about, but he brought up his wife, and I said, you know, I just want to be honest. I was really insulted that you didn't invite me to your wedding.
Right. And that kind of thing. Right. It can strengthen a relationship.
It did. And I was honest. I was like, I would not have gone because it was in Vermont and I just didn't feel like schlepping up there. But I was annoyed that you didn't invite me. And he responded, but you didn't invite me to your wedding, which is before his. And I was like, is that true? I was like, wait, I would. Are you sure? And then I went and I checked and I didn't. And it was so revealing and liberating that we had this talk. Mm-hmm. And now that grudge is gone. Yep. And we are much, you know,
much closer friends, probably.
I think so.
Yeah, I have a friend that was engaged, and he called all of his friends. He made the rounds to say, I am engaged. And I knew the woman that he was engaged with, and they had come to my house and spent a weekend, and it was horrible.
What was horrible about it?
Their relationship sucked.
Like, they were fighting all the time?
They were worse as a couple than they were as individuals.
Interesting.
You know that phenomena?
Uh-huh. So what did you do?
When he called, I said, oof, that's, you know, I'm your friend, so I have to tell you that I really don't think it's a good idea.
Interesting. And how did he react to that?
He said, well, okay, well, we're going ahead with it anyway. Thank you. That's it.
Interesting.
He was defensive, and he didn't know how to react.
Right.
So then fast forward about a month later, he has to make the rounds. He's calling all his friends again, saying, the wedding is off. It didn't work out. In the planning, we ended up fighting too much, and now she's a stranger to
me. So you were happy that you did that.
And he said to me, Gary, of all my friends and family, you are the only person that told me that I shouldn't marry her.
It's very interesting. Now, I have a friend who actually, just to provide the other perspective, He was getting married to this woman who's a friend of my wife's, and his best friend said, "I don't like that woman. She's not good enough for you."
Ooh.
And they ended up getting married, and
he wasn't invited to the wedding.
He was, weirdly, but he had told my wife's friend knew about it because her fiance told her. And now she just hates this guy.
Right.
With pretty good reason. So
that is the risk.
That is the risk, exactly.
But what are we supposed to do as friends?
I know, it's a tough one. It's a tough one. I don't know the answer, but I'm glad it worked out for you. That sounds like you made the right decision.
I guess for me. You mentioned earlier that you have a mentor.
Oh, yes, you're right. I did mention that. Mm-hmm. This guy, well, I would call him my mentors.
Just the concept of a mentor. Most people don't have mentors.
Right.
And most people really should have mentors.
Interesting. Do you have a mentor?
I don't, and I think it's a great idea.
Interesting. Yeah, maybe you can apply for a mentorship. Like you can.
How do you do that?
I don't know.
And I feel like I would need a mentor for kind of like all the different avenues in my life.
Right. You want like a romantic mentor.
Sure.
And like a career mentor.
Yeah.
I like that idea. Mm-hmm. Like making it a little more conscious in searching for your mentor. I think
mentor.com.
Mentor.com. Sign me up.
It's the new business.
Well, I will say I did have a mentee. I was a mentor for someone who, and I think it's not a lifetime position because he is now surpassed me in success, career success.
You were mentoring him just in career stuff?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. He didn't need... I'll tell you a story quickly because it's kind of interesting. It was when I was doing the Year of Living Biblically. And one of the worst rules in the Old Testament is that slavery is allowed. And I was like, what the hell am I going to do this? So this kid, he was a freshman at Brown University, mm-hmm. which is my alma mater. So he emailed me this actually very funny, creative email saying he wanted to be a writer and he wanted to be my assistant, my intern over the summer. And I was like, well, I guess like unpaid internship is kind of the closest thing to slavery that I can condone. So, all right, come be my intern if I can call you my biblical slave.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, all right. And I felt guilty about not paying him. So I took him to on a trip to Jerry Falwell's church, which was part of a research I was doing for the book. And he was fascinated. And on the way back, he said, you know, what if I transferred from Brown for a semester and spent a semester in, you know, the Bible Belt, a semester in Jesus Land, and wrote about it. I transferred from Brown to Liberty University, because that's Jerry Falwell's. That's the most conservative university in America.
Yeah.
Like, you can't watch R-rated movies. You can't hold hands with women. So I was like, that's an interesting idea. And I helped him write a book proposal, and I got it to my agent, and he got a book deal. And he wrote the book as a college student, and it was wonderful. It was great because it wasn't like a one-sided hatchet job. It was subtle. It showed the good and the bad of this way of life. But and so he was sort of, I considered him my protege, my mentee, and he was very nice to say that I was his mentor. But what I love is he's totally surpassed me because now he's a columnist at the New York Times and he's on the Daily, their podcast all the time talking about, because his beat is crazy. His beat is like online Nazis and the alt-right.
Oh, I probably heard him.
Kevin Roos.
Okay, yeah.
Great writer. Mm-hmm. The book was, by the way, The Unlikely Disciple, if anyone wants to pick it up, highly recommend. But
then that's kind of the best thing you could ask for as a mentor.
Yeah, I know.
As a parent, too. You want your children to be better than you.
I know. I mean, intellectually, if I would have predicted that he was more successful than me, I'm like, oh, man, I will be bitter. But weirdly, I'm not. I'm just happy for him.
Yeah, that's what you should want.
I know. I don't know why. I think it's because my ambition gets lower and lower every year. It's just like slowly frittering away, which I like.
Well, you have a new book that is just coming out or just came out when this podcast airs.
True. I mean, I still do try to do stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you keep your passion up? I mean, to do these life experiments requires so much passion.
Right. Well, that's true. I mean, two things. One, radically honestly, this book was due like 4 years ago. So it's not like I'm a machine. And secondly, luckily, I'm able to choose projects that I am already passionate about. Like, so I am, you know, if someone asked me to write a book about learning to play the French horn, I'd be like, you know what? That just doesn't excite me. But so I was able to come up with a bunch of ideas and pitch them to my publisher, and they're like, well, let's do this one. And it is something I'm obsessed with, which is like gratitude.
Right.
This idea of the book is called Thanks a Thousand, and I go around the world and try to thank 1,000 people who had even the tiniest role in making my morning cup of coffee a reality. So, you know, the obvious ones like the farmer and the barista, but like the totally non-obvious 6 degrees one, like, you know, the truck driver who drove the beans, but the guy who made the road for the truck and the guy who painted the yellow lines on the road.
The pallets that carried the coffee.
Oh, the pallets are huge.
Yeah,
I never knew that.
Pallets are such a big part of all of our lives.
They run the world.
Yeah.
Like everything in this room at one point, except for me and you, was probably on a pallet, which are like not the tongue pallet or the paint pallet, the sort of the big wooden platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and they saved the world, pallets, because we used them, the Allies used them in World War II to ship supplies before the Axis had figured it out.
Yeah, your book is really kind of similar to what a stand-up comedian does.
Hmm.
Because as a stand-up comedian, you have to break apart everything. You have to observe something and like break apart every little essence of it.
I love that.
And that's exactly what you did with your book. I mean, most people don't look at their cup of coffee and think of everything that went into it.
Right.
The farmers, the lids.
Yeah.
The graphic designer that made the lids, the little emblems on top of the lids.
Oh, sure.
Little logos and stuff.
Well, I love that. Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of stand-up comedy, so that is nice to hear. That angle. And I agree. I love the idea of looking at things that we take for granted, like the thousands of people involved in every tiny little thing we do. And, you know, I think it had some positive impact on me. It made me more grateful. And I talk about this, speaking of stand-up, I talk in the book about how I believe there are two sides to me and probably everyone. There's the Larry David side and the Mr. Rogers side.
Right.
And they are like constantly at war, like the cynical pessimist and the positive optimist. So my, this gratitude project was sort of an attempt to bulk up the Mr. Rogers side, get him ripped.
Right.
So that he can take on the Larry David.
Right. So when you're feeling like Larry David, you just don't write.
Exactly. And listen, I love Larry David. I would much rather watch the Larry David show than a Mr. Rogers episode.
Right.
But I would not rather live inside Larry David's head.
Mm.
I would much rather live inside Mr. Rogers' head.
Good
so that's
point.
The distinction.
Yeah. When you're writing, are you writing more than one book at once? Do you switch books, like, depending on your mood?
Mm, that's a good point. Maybe I should. Maybe that'll
be more
efficient.
Yeah, because then when you're feeling more negative, you can write that book.
I like that. Well, what I think, I guess the difference is, but all of my books have the positive and negative in them. So, like, if I'm in a bad mood, I can write the cranky part.
Right.
And then when I'm in a good mood, I can write the happier part. And what I think, one thing I have learned by being an old man is that I will, like, right now I'm in a pretty good place, but I know it's not forever. I'm going to like descend. There's going to be, you know, I'm going to be depressed. I don't know when or why, but so I don't get too cocky when I'm happy. And
right.
And when I am depressed, I'm like, you know what? This is not forever. I am going to come out of it. So I'm able to step back and be like, this is not permanent. This is.
Yeah. You've been there before.
Right.
And you know that it's just feelings.
Yeah,
and exactly. It could change.
Just feelings. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I tell myself is like, all right, I'm feeling depressed right now.
Mm-hmm.
but nothing has changed. I was happy yesterday.
Mm.
And nothing in my life has changed. I have no reason to be depressed now when I was happy yesterday and everything's the same.
Exactly.
So then I just sit with that thought. I'm like, all right.
Yeah. Well, you know what I also think of is, I mean, it, when I get 6.5 hours of sleep before, versus when I get 8 hours of sleep, it's crazy. Like 6.5 hours, sometimes I'll come out and like, the world is horrible. And like, and I'm like, but I realize, you know what? You had a shitty night's sleep. That's why your brain is saying this.
Right.
And like tomorrow you won't feel like that.
Right.
So it is funny how much, you know, how much, how important it is to sort of step back and realize your brain is messed up and don't believe everything that it tells you.
And it's funny because then you have two brains. You have the brain that's thinking about the other brain.
Exactly.
That's being stupid.
I agree. And
smart brain versus dumb brain.
Well, it's funny. I was just thinking about this the other day. I forget his name, but he was one of the original Saturday Night Live writers. He worked with Billy Crystal a lot. Mm-hmm. Do you remember his name?
I will not remember his name.
Anyway, I once did a panel with him, and I thought he had an interesting metaphor that writers especially, but maybe everyone, should have two heads,
mm-hmm.
like the head on the shoulder. So that's the head that's observing life, and then the head that's living it. So
right.
Like you always should be able to step back and be like, that's crazy, like what just happened. Let me, you know.
Yep. That's kind of what you have to do as a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, exactly. It was very stand-up comedy, or as like especially comedy. You have to have that other head.
Yeah, you have to be living it, but also a step back and observing what's going on.
Exactly.
Like Jerry Seinfeld. He doesn't just get peanuts and eat peanuts. He goes, what's the deal with these peanuts?
Exactly. I remember once the worst gig of my life was I had to do warm up for Jerry Seinfeld.
You did? That sounds like a great gig.
Well, you would think so, but think about it this way. And maybe, you know, my Mr. Rogers, I should say it's a great gig, but it was my synagogue, and it was like a fundraiser, and Jerry Seinfeld agreed to come on. But only for half an hour. He mm-hmm. would only do a half an hour of material. But they were charging people like, you know, $500 or whatever. So they had to have at least an hour of show. And they're like, you know, I belong to the synagogue. I don't go often. But they're like, well, why don't you get up there and tell some stories? And so, like, you know, everyone shows up and, like, I get on stage and everyone's like, wait a sec. That's not Jerry Seinfeld. That's
Did you just tell them you're just opening for Jerry? Jerry's coming, I swear.
Well, that's what I said. I was like, don't worry, Jerry will be here. I know I'm not Jerry. You know, I am Jewish, but I'm not Jerry. He'll be here, but I just have to tell you a few things.
Everyone's like, he looks so different than he does on TV.
Exactly. Maybe I should have tried to do that.
They're throwing matzo balls at you.
I know, it was tough. And he was funny because he lived a block away from the synagogue, so he said he came in literally like 5 seconds after I finished my set, and he got on stage and he's like, wasn't that great, everybody? That was AJ Jacobs. He's so funny. He had not seen a word I said.
Right. What a pro.
And then at the end of his set he's like, I love this gig because I am going to be in bed in my apartment before you all file out of this theater. And it was true.
Right.
He just like left side door.
He juggles that positive, negative thing.
That is true. That's a good point. He does.
Yeah. He seems like he's probably somewhere in that brain pretty miserable.
I do think, I mean, it helps at some points to be miserable to come up with comedy material, I would think.
Yeah, well, I think creativity in general, kind of for some reason, when you're feeling more negative, you're more creative.
Mm, right. Although I wonder, sometimes I feel the opposite. I do sometimes feel that way, but then sometimes I feel if I'm too down, I can't write because I'm just
right.
so annoyed.
You're just you're just done. Yeah. But like music, for example. You know, people write the best songs when their heart has just been broken.
Right, blues. That's the whole, like,
the blues.
Mm-hmm. Blues. It's true.
And happy music is horrible music.
What is happy? Give me some examples, aside from the Wiggles.
I think like Bare Naked Ladies or something, like just like real happy Hootie and the Blowfish, maybe. Christian rock, maybe.
But maybe we should get over that bias, because maybe it would be better for the world if people enjoyed happy music. Like the Lego Movie. Everything is awesome.
Right.
Ba, 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 ba.
Yeah.
Maybe that is better. Like, and we fetishize, we worship the negative because it just seems cooler.
Well, one of my early jobs was I worked at the Warfield Theater in San Francisco. And, you know, I worked so many concerts. And the Bare Naked Ladies played, and their music is very happy and up, and the singer's smiling the whole time. There were more fights in that concert than Slayer.
Interesting.
Than like every, the metalheads are very peaceful people. And Bare Naked Ladies, for some reason, so many different fights broke out. I think people saw all the happiness and they just got this adverse reaction to it.
Yeah, they were jealous. They're like,
maybe they were jealous.
That's very interesting. Yes. All right, I will stay away from Bare Naked Ladies concerts.
Only listen to heavy metal. So what are you going to do now? You just finished that book. It's just coming out. You have a new project in the works.
Well, I've got this one thing that's super time consuming as part of promoting the Thanks a Thousand book, the gratitude book. I said that I would write 1,000 handwritten personalized notes to readers.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who goes on my website can fill out this form and they can tell me what they say, like, because I want to personalize it. And it's been wonderful and a pain in the ass simultaneously.
You're only doing 1,000, right?
Well, I've actually expanded it because I hit 1,000 and I'm going to do another few hundred.
Uh-huh.
Because I actually, you know, as I say, it's a pain in the ass, but also I love it because it's like, you know, as a writer, as a stand-up, I'm very jealous. You get immediate feedback.
Right.
People are laughing. Oh, that's funny. Like, I'm sitting in a room. I don't know whether it's connecting with people. So this is a really lovely, people are writing, you know, what struck them, and they're asking for personalized. I've gotten a lot of interesting requests. A lot of people ask me to thank their dog. So I'm writing notes to their dog.
Uh-huh.
One guy asked me to thank his ex-wife, which I thought was nice, like a conscious uncoupling. And then just weird requests like, please draw me a taco. All right, I'll draw you a taco. I don't care.
So you're writing these notes and then you're physically mailing
to
them?
Yeah, physically mailing them. Mm-hmm. And that has been way more time consuming than it should be.
Yeah.
But also fulfilling. So that has delayed me a little. But I do want to write another book. I'm figuring it out. I am particularly obsessed with truth, the concept of truth.
Very fitting for our times.
Yeah, exactly. Truth decay, as there's a book called Truth Decay, which I love.
Uh-huh.
Not that I like puns too much, but I thought it was a clever one.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
But yeah, like, how do we know what we know? How do we know what's true? And it's just, I think, going to get more and more tricky with deep fake videos are terrifying to me.
Right.
That you can use software to get Obama to say Heil Hitler.
And
it's impossible to say whether it's real or not. So how are we going to navigate the world when we're in this epistemological crisis?
And also people believing what they want to believe.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what we're talking about. The motivated reasoning, I think, is one of the biggest problems in the world.
Yeah.
It's like the mother of all cognitive biases.
I would love to see this book come out right before the election of 2020.
I was thinking that. I got to get off my ass.
Like, we got to end this interview so you can write.
I know, exactly.
You got to save the world.
We do have to end it because I have to pee.
Yeah, me too, actually.
I'm just being radically honest about the peeing.
That's good.
Yeah. But I loved talking. That was super fun.
Yeah, it flew by. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Gary.